Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello everybody, Andy Burt here. Welcome along to episode 182 of the Early Excellence podcast. In this week's episode, we have a special educational needs focus. We talk to Jenny Necvatel about her experience as a parent of children with autism, and we ask her and chat to her about key advice for effective practice when working with children with SEND. So a really interesting chat. So here you go. Here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Jenny Necvatel. Jenny, it's lovely to see you. Thank you so much for joining us for the podcast.
Wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. And of course, you join us from the other side of the world. So thank you very much for fitting us in. We're going to talk about special educational needs, which I know is a real passion for you, something that you know a lot about, of course, from both your professional side, but also your personal life as well. And I wondered if we could start off with an introduction, if that's okay. Would you mind telling us about your background? Because you've got a really interesting background, I think.
Thank you. So I've been in the early childhood sector for over 30 years and filled, you know, a number of roles in that. I've been teacher, director, head of department at TAFE, which is, I guess, a step here between school and university. So sometimes students will go to university to get their teaching degree, or they might go to the RTO or the like TAFE level where you receive a diploma or a Cert 3 in early childhood. So I've sort of, worked in the adult learning sector as well and loved all my roles in the early childhood space. And I'm also the parent of three children, two of whom live with a disability. So Ryan and Zach are on the spectrum. They're level 3 on the autism spectrum. They are nonverbal. They have an intellectual delay. And they're also incontinent. So we had a lot of challenges when they were growing up. And that's where my passion for special needs disability has come from. And it's sort of all intertwined, really, because I wrote a book called Embracing Disability in Early Childhood, and also have two businesses, one business in the disability sector. So I found it all just intertwined, really, and just came together.
Yes. But in lots of ways, that is the best way for it to happen, and that actually it's something you're passionate about. It's not something that you kind of, it's a sort of 9-to-5 job that you kind of stop and you go, well, that's one part of my life and here's another part of my life. Actually, you are fascinated by it and interested in it because actually it means something to you. It's something that is very much at your heart, I think. And I think from chatting to you previously, we chatted, didn't we, a month or so ago, I think that really comes across that actually that's something that you don't just see as a job. It's something that actually is very much part and parcel of your life. It's close to your heart.
Yes, well, it has been for my boys are now 22. I have to stop and think. They have moved out of home. They moved out last year, so they're in supported independent living. So that has given us a lot more space, I guess, to be able to do what I'm doing now. But without them, I wouldn't have had the reason to write the book or to have that urge to go out and do workshops with early childhood educators and talk about what it's like to receive that diagnosis of disability, how to have those hard conversations, and just learning more about autism and sensory processing disorder so that educators can better understand and support the children that are in the services.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And what I think comes across is that because you've got that both professional experience and also personal experience, there's a lot of weight to what you're saying. You know, you're somebody who has lived and breathed it for 20 plus years, not just within a setting, but also at home as well. And that you, I'm sure along that way, will have learned from, in the way that every parent does, learned from things that you do that doesn't quite work. And then you sort of readdress it and you think, well, we'll try it a different way. You know, that I think is really valuable both to early childhood educators, but also to parents as well. I think to hear from somebody who's been there and done it and to have known what it feels like, I think holds a lot of weight, doesn't it?
It does. And it's also really frustrating with children that on the autism spectrum, because you might have your routine set up and all your sensory activities set up and they're working, and then suddenly it's no longer regulating them, so you have to find something else. So I also say it's just really frustrating as well, because you get everything sorted and they go, oh no, I'm good now, I'm all regulated, I'm going to, you know, need something else. And so then you're scrambling to try and find what that next thing is. So yes, there's certainly a toolbox of ideas there, because we have tried, yes, absolutely everything at different times. Very strange and bizarre things sometimes, but they worked.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing, isn't it? And to a certain extent, it's trial and error and getting, you know, trying to get it right, and nobody gets it right all of the time. But that's quite, and that in itself is quite difficult, I think. I was going to ask you about the wording of it. Because already, you know, when we're talking about, I would always use, certainly in the UK, that the term special educational needs, where you're using the term disability. And I wanted to ask you about that. Has there been a shift in language within Australia? Has that always been the case that you've used the term disability? Or do different people use different terms?
Disability is probably more recent, and this is something that I talk about in the book, because I just say to educators they need to feel comfortable with what they're using. Otherwise, when they're having conversations with families, they won't come across as feeling confident. So when I first started in my career, it was probably additional needs was the first term, then came special needs. And special needs was probably around for quite a long time. But I think what made the big change in Australia is we had the National Disability Insurance Scheme, the NDIS, come in, and I think it's been in for around 8 to 10 years now. So
okay. Yeah.
With that, I think everybody then started talking about disability and using the term living with a disability rather than special needs, additional needs. Some people still use it. Some parents do. Occasionally you will see it in different organisations or businesses that use it, but it probably the word disability is more frequently used here in Australia.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. Okay. And I was going to ask you as well, from a personal side of things, first of all, you mentioned that you have, of course, three children, and that two of your children have special educational needs and one of your children doesn't. From a starting point, that presumably creates or presents a challenge, I would imagine. No,
it did.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, Kate is 3.5 years older than the boys. So Ryan and Zach are twins. And I guess it was always, I guess having twins, you're always very concerned about not focusing on them all the time, making sure that, you know, when they're born, the other sibling gets attention, all that sort of thing. So I think you're very aware of that. And then when you also have the disability diagnosis and you have therapy and all those sorts of things on top of it, which are really time consuming, because you need to do therapy out of the home, you need to do therapy at home. Because they were on the autism spectrum, they really needed a structured routine. We couldn't do things that families normally do, like a trip to the shops, you know, it could be an absolute nightmare. You know, I guess if you had, you know, the school had an event, or, you know, there's an Easter egg hunt, you don't go to those community events because they just don't cope. So we were very aware of her missing out on those sorts of things as well. When she was in primary school, her friends were, you know, were quite accepting, and they probably continued into that into high school, but she became much more, you know, aware, a teenager, and, you know, all those issues.
And naturally more self-conscious anyway, you know, as a teenager. So I guess that presents an issue.
Yeah, that was the hard part, and still just trying to juggle everything. She was quite good at athletics, so trying to get her to her athletics carnivals at sort of, you know, regional and state level. And then, and now she's just absolutely amazing. I mean, she's 25 now. So, you know, I guess sort of once she went away to university and probably just had a little bit of a break as much as anything from them, you know, she's really supportive. She's very involved in any decisions we make around them. She moved back to where we live after university, and she goes and, you know, sees them a couple of times a week now that they're in their own home. You know, when we were sort of desperate for help sometimes, she would come over and help us once she'd got back from uni and stuff like that. But it is a really hard balance to make sure that the child that doesn't have a disability isn't missing out and that they get to have their say. And yeah.
And presumably you are asked about that from a professional side as well. Are you asked about?
Not a great deal. No, that's often not always something that comes up. Yeah, but certainly something that I think is very important. And if I get the opportunity, I always throw it in there. But maybe that's something I need to focus on a little bit more.
In going back to that, then what would be the more common things that you would be asked? That's quite an interesting thing, isn't it? You know, what would people ask you about from a professional side? I suppose, you know, if they are working within an earlier setting, as a teacher or a practitioner, and they've got children with special educational needs within the setting, and they are trying to build that relationship with the parents, perhaps, or they're working with the child within the setting. What are the more common questions that you tend to be asked?
They're usually around behaviour, because what we find here is, I don't know if it's the same in England, but there's a lot of, there's a rise in ADHD, autism, all those sorts of things, but getting children diagnosed in those early years is quite difficult because there's a wait list for pediatricians or for, you know, specialists to do the diagnosis. Quite often it's educators will ask around that frustration of parents not wanting to hear that there's a disability. So that's one of the workshops I do is around having hard conversations with parents, and it's teaching them, one, the awareness of why parents may not want to hear what they're saying and how to have those conversations. But I also say, I've been on both sides. So as an educator, I always tell a story where I had a family who, you know, I was the director of the centre, the teacher and I, we spoke to the family, and it was just, oh, no, she's fine. I was like that when I was a child. And then once the child was at school in what we call year two, I saw the mother just down at the shops and had a chat, and this child was still doing reading recovery, which she shouldn't have been doing at that age. She should have, like, in that sort of where she was at school. So it was really frustrating that if the parents had, I guess, accepted what we had, like our concerns, and maybe access some early intervention for that child, she might have just been ready, more ready for school, better able to cope. So I come from the side of being a mum who didn't want to hear that her children had a disability, and I tell how terrible I was at acknowledging that. And that, yes, I've been on the other side, and it's really frustrating when parents won't listen to you. So they're the main, probably the two big things. Behavior and yeah, having those hard conversations with parents, why parents aren't listening, and then looking at around like the sensory processing thing. So how do they create an environment that helps those children? I had a service in a town that's about an hour and a half away from here, and in their preschool room, which is the year before they go to school, they probably had like 70% of the children in that group either had a diagnosis or were in the process of or needed a diagnosis. And, you know, obviously that was a really difficult room to be in. And so I did sort of like a customized workshop for them, looking at the sense, what their room looked like and those sorts of things, and suggested some ideas around sensory processing. And once they were able to put that into place, just made a difference. And it's realizing things like that and being prepared to do just tiny little things that you might think, oh, look, we've got all these issues happening, we need the big answer. But realizing that if you just do some little thing, that can help. So it probably boils down to behavior a lot of the time.
Okay.
Educators are just pulling their hair out.
Could you give us some examples of what those small things that you could do that would improve praxis? What would they be? So in terms of the sensory experiences.
Yeah. So one of the things that this service did, I suggested having some white noise or some sort of relaxation music playing during the day, because it was really difficult, because in that group of children, some just their level, their ability to deal with different noises, it just varied so much. But they found that putting the white noise on during the day just decreased, you know, some of those behaviours, and the children just a lot calmer, and having more intentional movement breaks. So for those children who need to move, who need that movement to like stabilise their sensory processing, they would just calmer. So they started doing just a 5-minute movement break every half hour, and they just found that made a difference. And the staff said they really enjoyed it as well, because it gave them time to sort of decompress and relax as well. So sometimes it's just, you know, those tiny little things that sometimes you do hear about them, and you hear about, you know, mindfulness breaks and all these sorts of things. You think, oh, we don't have time for that. We've got 20 kids running in the room. But it's surprising how little things like that, sometimes even just turning the lights off at different times of the day, because some children can be very sensitive to light, and that may just be too much for them. So they tried quite a few things like that and just, yeah, found some differences. So
and in the same way that we talked about in terms of personally for you, that kind of trial and error at home of what works, what doesn't work, what works for a short period of time but then maybe doesn't seem to be working, presumably you would talk about something similar when you're talking with teachers and practitioners, that actually in a way nothing works all of the time to a certain extent, you know, that actually, but here's a toolkit of different sorts of things that might well work, that are worth a try. And so lighting might be one of them. Movement breaks, I think we would call them sensory circuits. I don't know whether, is that a term that you're familiar with?
I haven't heard that one. I like that.
Yeah. That idea of kind of having a break and going through an order of things, of things that actually there's a structure there that we're going to do, and you are familiar with that structure. And it's a way of getting moving, but also a way of using your brain or using your body in different ways, and having those sensory experiences if that's what you need, and all of those sorts of things. So, yeah, it's an interesting term. I want to also, alongside that, I thought it was interesting to go back a step, if that's all right. You talked about from your own personal view of from when you'd got that diagnosis, and you talked about kind of from an early stage of having conversations with the teachers or practitioners, and that you yourself weren't in a place where you were ready to listen, and you know, and you were sort of saying that actually, you know, that's really hard. I think one of the challenges as a teacher or practitioner is to be empathetic you know, to be able to sit in the other person's chair, really, you know, if their parent there, and to appreciate what that must be like as a parent who, of young children, where it must feel like the rug has been pulled from under you. Does that make sense? And I know one of the things you talked about when we chatted previously was about a grief stage. And I thought it might be helpful to talk about that, if that's all right, because I think for teachers and practitioners to be able to empathize, I think that's sometimes half the battle.
Yes. And I'll get to the grief process in a moment, but I sort of say to educators, and I guess the reason I wrote the book was I was frustrated because I could see that educators didn't know how to have those conversations or didn't understand why parents weren't wanting to have meetings, and, you know, you'd have a conversation and the parents would go, oh, no, no, it's fine, or, okay, I'll make a paediatrician appointment, but 6 months later they still hadn't. And I say to the educators, it's a case of you don't know what you don't know. They don't understand what it's like to be that parent because they're not in that situation. If they don't have children or if they haven't got a child that's being has been diagnosed or, you know, is potentially going to have a diagnosis of disability, then you can't understand what it's like. So I always, you know, emphasize that. And that's why I talk about it, so that they can have a little bit of that understanding and awareness of what it could be like. And with the grief process, it's different for everybody because, you know, they might initially go through denial, but then, you know, another part of it is acceptance. And some might be so glad that they've finally got a reason. And often parents will say, I was so glad to hear it's not my bad parenting, because that's been told by so many people, or often family members, that they were a bad parent. That to actually have a diagnosis and a piece of paper that said, well, you know, your child's on the autism spectrum or whatever it was, they were actually relieved. So it's a process that you will just go in and, like, in and out of at different times. And I found that with my husband and I, we probably, if I was really down about things, he'd sort of be more positive, and then it would be vice versa.
Yes, you'd sort of support each other.
Yeah.
And balance it out.
And we probably didn't really get through that process. I mean, you don't fully get through it, but I think around age sort of 15, when the boys were 15, we sort of just went, well, yeah, this is it, you know, and just accepted it. And I guess it's when, you know, you have an 18th birthday, a 21st, and Ryan and Zach have no idea that their birthday, and they really couldn't care less. Zach thinks it's great because he gets cake because he loves cake and sugar and lollies and all that sort of thing. So, and Ryan's like, oh, yeah, I'll eat a bit of cake. So I think, yeah, you just go through different stages at different times. So,
yes. And is it, you know, again, trying to sort of empathize and trying to sort of feel or get an idea of what that feeling is like, is it akin to grief? Does it feel like grief? Does it feel that you've lost somebody in a way?
You probably lost the idea of what they were going to be. So when you're pregnant, or, you know, whether it's, you know, going to be your child or niece, nephew, or, you know, good friends having a baby, I think you always have this vision of what will happen. If it's, you know, your own child, you think, oh, you know, we'll have family picnics, or, you know, the family lunch on Sunday. And, you know, if it's your niece, you think, oh, I'll be able to, you know, give the parents a break and take them wherever. Or, you know, a good friend, you might think, oh, well, you know, my child will be able to play with their child, or something like that. And you have to come to terms with losing, I guess, that idea of what you had thought that life would be like and what that child would be like. So, yes, all those things that, you know, you thought of them, you know, learning to ride a bike and, you know, maybe going camping, or things like that, which, yeah, we just weren't able to do with our boys.
So things that in your head you'd kind of already thought, oh, it'll be great when, you know, I suppose you think back to your own childhood and you think, oh, my childhood was great because I learned to ride a bike and I went camping and I played football and I did this and I did that. And that then forms an image of what you then think your children's childhood is going to be. And then presumably overnight that then kind of just goes in a flash. And there must be a shock to that, I would think.
Yes. And I think it's also tricky because I guess for us, we didn't know the extent of what it was going to be, because there wasn't a lot of information about autism at that time either. Whereas now, I think, you know, they now call it level 1, 2, 3, and it's just more seen in the community than it was when our boys were younger. So I think it was hard to know what it would be like, and it was that unknown, not knowing what it would be like, that was hard.
Yes, yeah, definitely. So then for teachers and practitioners who are having difficult conversations with parents and hopefully getting past that first stage of actually having a meeting or being able to have a conversation, an open conversation about where they're at, do you have key bits of advice that you could share with people about those conversations that you know will make a difference? Are there certain things, almost sort of key things from your point of view that you think, well, I would definitely recommend this and steer away from this? Are there any key bits that you could share?
The most important part is always to keep in mind that the child is a child and they are who they are. So always value that child and their capabilities, and always just talk about them as a person and know their strengths and know the child really well and listen to what the parents have to say, because quite often the parents will see things at home that you don't see at the service, especially with autism, but even other disabilities, they might be doing things at home that they're not doing at the service or the school. So just listen to what the parents have to say and then look at how you can incorporate that into what you're doing. So if there's something that the child really enjoys or does easily at home, how can you incorporate that into your everyday practice? And yeah, listen to the parents, because they know their child best. And you can learn so much from those parents and those conversations that you have. So if you lose the "I'm the teacher, I'm the educator, I know what I'm doing, I've got all this knowledge, I've been to university or whatever it is, so I know everything and this is where they should be, this is what they should be doing," leave all that, let all that go and listen to what the parents have to say, and yeah, be open-minded, because it doesn't matter how they achieve something as long as they're doing it. And they might have a different way of getting there. You might think they have to do 1, 2, 3, but they might go 5, 6, 7 and do something else. And at the end of the day, you might go, "Do you know what? That was so much easier. That was a really good way to do it."
Yes.
So.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. So certainly the dynamics need to change to a certain extent, where quite often I think within an educational setting, particularly in schools, I think we talk about, certainly in the UK, we have sort of parents' evenings and things like that, where the dynamics is often the parent is coming along to find out how the child is doing at school. And that's okay to a point, but I think it breaks down when we're talking about children with special educational needs. In that if the dynamics is set towards actually you've got one expert and somebody who's just coming to listen, I think actually that you don't get the best out of that situation. Arguably, you don't get the best out of it anyway, in that actually if every parent of young children have got, they're an expert in their child.
Absolutely, yes. You look at that parent as the expert.
Yeah, it's not just about special educational needs, but I think it's more so when we're talking about children with special educational needs, that the when we're particularly when we're talking about really specific needs, that those parents, as you said right from the outset, will have tried and failed and tried and failed so many different things that they will know at the moment what works, even if it won't work in 3 or 4 weeks' time or even tomorrow. That kind of thing, that this has worked at the moment and they've got such a lot to share. And I think that is crucial advice. I think sometimes we get caught up in that idea of, well, we're the professional, so I've got to have to say something and I've got to come across as the expert, but I don't know. When actually, I think we come across far better when we're quite honest and we say, I'm finding this difficult at the moment. Can we create a relationship where we can support one another? I think that's difficult, but I think it's beneficial to everybody. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. We had the best relationships with the teachers at our boys' school. We had excellent teachers, but they were also, they always said to us, you know the boys better than we do, you're the experts. And they would always listen to us. And, you know, sometimes we had to have some very honest, difficult conversations. But we felt comfortable doing that because of the way that we were respected, but also Ryan and Zach were always at the forefront of those conversations and they were what was important. So they were always seen as, yeah, they were there at the forefront, though, the most important. It was about them. It wasn't about, yes, the teachers knowing more or as not knowing anything or knowing more or whatever. It was that they were at the forefront and we were there to work together, share our information and work out what was best for Ryan and Zach. So
yeah, absolutely.
That's what it's all about.
Absolutely. Presumably there must have been a, and I'm guessing this, I don't know, but a sort of almost an element as a parent of a child with particular needs, isn't that feeling of when they are going into the setting, almost wanting to keep them tight to you? You know, that sort of almost to put a barrier around them, to put a blanket around them and kind of not let this outside world get to your child who you're trying to protect. Does that make sense? The reason I say it is that as a father of three children who are now quite a bit older, I think back to the time when sort of my children were nursery age, and I think that's a natural thing anyway, that you kind of want to put a bit of a kind of a blanket around your child and kind of hold them close and just protect them. And it's difficult to walk away from to drop them off at nursery because actually you feel like actually you just want to protect them at that point. And I wonder whether as a parent of a child with particular needs, of special educational needs, whether you feel that but times by 100. Is that right? I don't know.
It is. Yes, it is. And I do talk about that in the book about concerns that parents might have when putting their child in an early childhood centre. That sounds terrible. You know what I mean? When they're enrolling them in.
In nursery or in any sort of early
if
setting.
You've got a child who's nonverbal like our boys were, well, they couldn't tell people what they wanted. They couldn't say that they were hungry or thirsty or anything like that. At one of the services I worked at, we had a child who was peg-fed and we had never had a child who needed to be peg-fed. So our staff actually, the mother came in to train the staff on how to do it. So, you know, and she was quite confident.
Fed through a tube. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, it sort of goes through a tube into their stomach.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There may be another word for it, I don't know. But that's
No. I just wanted to check that I understood what you were saying. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, for that mum to get to a stage where she trusted the staff to do that, that must have been so difficult for her to have the trust that it would work, because this is the only way this child could eat. So, you know, if something went wrong, either that child, you know, might not eat at that session, or, you know, there could have been complications with the tube, all sorts of things. So, yeah, it's very, very daunting to, yeah, to send your child off to school or daycare and, yeah, to trust in those educators and teachers that they, I guess, can keep your child safe as much as anything else, and then educate them on top of that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I find that sort of, to a certain extent, almost like the psychology of it, of the, you know, as a parent and how you engage with your children, and particularly then with children with a special educational need, and how you then share that with the setting and the staff within the setting. I think that's really interesting, and it's also very complex from both sides. I think from a professional side, you've got, as I said before, you've got that feeling of, well, I need to come across as the professional, somebody who's been to university, done the training, got the t-shirt, I know everything about this. From a parent's side, you've got all of the baggage, the emotional baggage, the stress, but also the expertise that you want to share. But at the same time, you're in a difficult place in terms of almost like that grief stage at the same point. And that's so hard. But it's fascinating, I think, looking at it, standing back from it and looking at it, I think is quite interesting. I know that people listening to this will be really interested to know more. I think, you know, what you've said already, I think there's such a depth there. There's such a level of expertise, both from a professional side and from a parental side. And I know certainly, and I'm sure this is the same for you in Australia, certainly over the last 5 years or so, particularly, and probably more actually, there's been such a focus on children with special educational needs. We've had a real change in terms of how we've had numbers of children coming into settings that we've not seen before with particular needs, and that has really challenged teachers and practitioners who might not have encountered this number of children with this amount of need before. And so conversations, certainly in the UK, are happening all of the time around this, and people are challenged by it, but are also fascinated by it. And so you mentioned your book earlier on. Is it widely available? And if so, you know, how can people get hold of a copy? Because certainly from hearing you speak, I'm sure everybody would say, right, I need to get hold of that. Can you tell us about it?
Yeah. So it's on, you can get it through amazon.com.uk or whatever you have over there. Yeah, but you certainly don't want to buy it off my website and have to pay postage all the way from Australia to England. I won't do that to you. It's ridiculous. So, yeah, certainly just jump on to Amazon. It's available on there. I am doing a presentation at the Bright Start Conference in November around having hard conversation, and also have...
Is that in Australia?
No, it's in London and Dubai.
Okay.
But I'm doing it on my part, will be online. Yes.
I see.
Unfortunately, I'm not coming to London or Dubai. No.
That would have been very nice. But
it
yes.
It would be. Yeah.
Yes.
As I said to you before, I've got all my relatives are in England. So, yes, coming for that would have been fantastic. But not yet. So, yes, I'm doing that in November. And I can also do online workshops as well. So, I provide either face to face or online workshops around like understanding autism. Yeah, so services can certainly, or schools can contact me, and yeah, always open to having conversations about how I can help educators and families.
Well, there's certainly a lot of need there, and I'm sure that you're a busy person. I'm sure you are.
But I love to do it. There's nothing better than you know, seeing it sort of all quick. I did a workshop a few weeks ago for a service where it was actually just, there were two children that they were just finding their behaviour difficult. And so I went and observed these two children, and basically my focus was, well, you need to turn the lens around so that you look at the behaviour was actually their communication, so why are they communicating the way? And did several visits beforehand and then did a workshop, and it was fantastic to hear the conversation and hear them talking, and I guess seeing those little light bulb moments where they went, oh, okay, he's not doing that because he wants to hit me. He's doing that because, you know, maybe it's too noisy, or we just went out of routine, or he's hungry, thirsty, and he hasn't been able to tell us. So, yeah, I just love doing it. It's so good to be able to help the educators, but also knowing it's the children and the families. So,
yes. Yeah. And like you say, I'm sure very often that through your work, you must see a lot of those light bulb moments, those moments where you say, when this child is exhibiting this behavior, that's them showing you that there is something that they need, and they can't express that. They're not able to tell you. So this is their way of telling you. And that once you start to unpick that, if you can work out what it is, whether it be that they're hungry, or whether it is that actually they're not comfortable, or they need some sort of sensory opportunity, once you unpick that, that's a game changer potentially, isn't it, in terms of the practice? And it would feel very rewarding, I'm sure.
Yeah, and this service even came up with ideas themselves. I went, oh, we could set up so-and-so as a bit of a swing or something like that. And I was actually speaking to one of the educators a few days later, and she said they did set up some sort of a swing, and he could actually just go and hop in that swing. Then he'd come out, go and do something, come back and hop in it. And they said, oh, it was an absolute game changer. We did not have, you know, any behaviours. And that was an idea they came up with themselves, but it was me talking about what that sensory processing was, and yes, why he's having those behaviours. And so it was just a joint project, I guess, solution. So, yeah.
Absolutely.
Good to see it happen.
Very good to see. Very rewarding. Very rewarding, definitely. Jenny, it's been brilliant to talk to you. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been absolutely brilliant. You know, what you say, you know, it makes perfect sense anyway. But as I said at the very beginning, that, you know, it adds extra weight that actually you listen, you know, somebody like me, you listen to what you're saying, and you know that you have got that wealth of experience, both as a teacher and as a parent. And actually, you've kind of brought the two worlds together in what you're saying and sharing. So, yeah, thank you so much. It's been brilliant to chat to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. It's been really good.
So there you go. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you found the episode useful. Now you can stay in touch with all things Early Excellence by joining our mailing list, and also, of course, following us on all of the social media platforms as well. Okay, have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.